goes, whichever leaves, I can't let go. You plant the seeds.
Welcome to Bending the Arc. Bending the Arc is a show offered by the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition and here on KKRN Community Supported Radio. On this show, we speak to people who are interested primarily in criminal legal reform of some type and are either working within or outside the system. And we are looking in this season more broadly examine impacts on people and laws here in Shasta County and beyond. And so some of our conversations in the future are going to be related to environmental issues. And so today I have the great pleasure of speaking to David Takash, who is a friend and a preeminent scholar, I would say, in environmental law. David, you might say even more than that, but I will let you introduce yourself in any way you see fit.
Sure. Thanks, Sharon, for having me. As Sharon said, I have been a professor of environmental law at University of California Law School in San Francisco, which used to be called University of California Hastings College of the Law and recently changed its name. So we're now University of California Law School, San Francisco. I teach U.S. Environmental law, as well as climate change law, international environmental law, and biodiversity law.
And you had an interesting journey to environmental law. Tell us a little bit about why you decided to go into law and what was drawing you at that moment, given your past.
Well, I've always been interested in environmental issues and working on behalf of human and non-human communities and the interrelationships between them. I had chosen a different path. I had been teaching environmental studies in the California state system. And I can go back beyond that if you want. And at some point, I decided to leave that job and go back to law school in middle age and get a credential that would allow me to work more directly for the communities that I cared about. I didn't expect to become a law professor, but that's where I ended up.
So it was that desire for more direct action, like being more...
it was a desire for direct action. It was also at a teaching at a campus, which was somewhat dysfunctional and frustrating, and I decided that I didn't want to spend the rest of my career there. So I decided to retool and go back to school. To do more direct action that you're talking about, to have a credential. No matter how many jokes we make about lawyers, it is one of, if not the most powerful degree you can actually earn when you walk into the room and you have a law degree. You make the rules and you enforce the rules. And so I wanted to have that degree too.
Absolutely. I'm just finishing reading What If We Got It Right? And you know, it's a book where the author speaks to a lot of different people and, you know, asking them what would the future look like if we got our response to climate change, you know, correct. And invariably, people coming from different perspectives and different places, they're talking about land regulation, they're talking about environmental laws, they're talking about the EPA. There's a lot of rules and legislation that need to happen.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And now you're helping to shape young minds internationally, because you teach internationally as well, right?
Right. Even though I've retired from my full-time job, I teach biodiversity law every summer at Vermont Law and Graduate School, and I teach every year in the master's program at the University of Melbourne in Australia, and I've taught a couple of times at Leiden University Law School in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm. So about biodiversity, you've written what seems to be still the definitive book on biodiversity. What were some of the central debates or tensions related to biodiversity maybe then, and how you see that having developed now?
Right. So I don't know that I've written the definitive book on biodiversity. I wrote a book called The Idea of Biodiversity, which explained or analyzed where did this idea come from. And in particular, it was about the dawn of the discipline of conservation biology. And conservation biology was, quote unquote, an action-oriented science. It wasn't just scientists doing what scientists normally do, but scientists not only collecting data about ecosystems and biodiversity, but also in trying to intervene to save the things that they cared about, the things that they studied, the things that they loved. And it was the dawn of that discipline, and also the tensions involved in, well, if science gets its authority in the world through objectivity, what happens if you then become a political actor on behalf of the things that you're objectively studying? That's what that book was about.
Yeah, that was a really interesting time, and I was studying evaluation, program evaluation theory, and the same debates about what exactly is objectivity and the qualitative basis of quantitative knowing in the first place. So things our listeners may or may not be super interested in. But yeah, that right at that center of like what are we doing this for? And there being a spectrum right within science of where you engage.
Oh, and first of all, whether you engage or not, and if you do, where is appropriate, and how, when are you stepping outside the boundaries of your expertise? And I think anyone in kind of mission-oriented science that isn't just in a laboratory somewhere doing things, but is engaged with problems that affect the world, whether it's medical science or environmental science, that every scientist has to face that question of, when do I step out of my lab and wear a different hat? And so,
Yeah, beyond the applied science kind of, yeah, rubric. So I am not in your field, and I am not as steeped in the literature that you are reading, but it seems like there hasn't been recently, sort of more in the public arena, as much conversation about biodiversity or biodiversity loss. Part of that, I mean, is that true in your field as well? And is there an important reframing that's happening?
great questions. There are these two interrelated, intertwined crises that affect the planet and affect the future of human civilization. There's climate change and there's biodiversity loss. And sometimes biodiversity advocates or biodiversity lawyers or people care about biodiversity talk about having climate envy. That people pay lots of been paying for quite a while, lots of attention to climate and much less attention to biodiversity. We should be paying all the attention to climate that we are paying. That is not that is, but we're also not paying attention to the fact that Earth's ecosystems are unraveling and species are going extinct, even as we're having this conversation, and that has terrible, significant implications not only for the natural world that is apart from us, but also the natural world that is a part of us that we are fundamentally dependent upon. And I think there's a lot less understanding of that discussion about that than there should be. It's part of why I get to teach it in places, because we don't have people teaching about this, and students, future practitioners, are actually really, really interested in this, as they should be, as we all should be, I think.
What would part of your pitch be to say a school, not as prestigious school that's looking to, do we address that more formally? Do we have courses in it? How do you speak to that impact?
So there's a couple of different ways you can go about it. First of all, you can go about it saying, well, whether or not you believe that God created everything that's out there, evolution created everything that's out there, we share the planet with a magnificent range of other creatures, other plants and animals, and that it is our responsibility to steward the planet that we've been given. That's not an argument that necessarily works for people. And so you can also go to the more instrumental argument, which is that we are fundamentally dependent on the natural world. The natural world gives us food. It pollinates all of our crops. It filters water. It cleans the air. It does everything that we depend upon in our daily life. We are fundamentally interconnected with that natural world. And unless we pay greater attention to that natural world, there's very little hope for us going forward as well. So you can try to depend, you can try to sell that as well. If I were to make a pitch.
Yeah, and that so understanding how we are connected to all kind of things and understanding how the those connections inform what's feeding us, what's pollinating our flowers, yeah, is really
And
critical.
what the threats are to those interconnections right now, what we should be doing to alleviate those threats.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KKRN, Community Supported Radio. This is Bending the Arc, and my conversation with environmental lawyer and all around great human, David Takahashi. You're really familiar with climate change advocates, how, those conversations are unfolding and probably on many more levels than most of us. What opportunities do you see for integrating conversations about biodiversity? I mean, I think we, often we approach these things, a public approaches these things as a very, kind of black and white. It's either or we have to give more, ascendancy to one thing. And how do you see the ways that we could better integrate those perspectives,
Sure.
mindsets?
Well, one of the things I've written about and like to think about is the way that these two crises are fundamentally interconnected, and that solutions to these crises, instead of saying today over here, these people are going to talk about climate change, and over there, those people are going to talk about biodiversity, that all solutions should be fundamentally intertwined. So, for example, if we are interested in reducing greenhouse gases, 20% of greenhouse gas emissions more or less come from deforestation. Well, that deforestation is when you are losing millions of acres every year of forests, you're not only releasing millions of acres of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, thus making climate change worse, you're also removing the home for Earth's imperiled species. So part of the solution for climate change could and should be paying attention to deforestation, making sure to reforest, making sure that when we reforest, we don't just plant a million eucalyptus trees in a monoculture, but that you're actually reforesting with native species that make for functioning ecosystems. That's just one small example. You can also think about some of our one of the lovely things. One thing I like to say is that even if it turns out some of the critics of climate change think that climate change is one big hoax. But even if they're right, all the things that we're doing about climate change, reducing pollution, helps all kinds of human health, helps us all live longer lives, helps us breathe better. Instead of digging for coal or digging or drilling for oil or fracking, solar panels, wind, these geothermal energy, these are much more sustainable, less polluting solutions that can help us in the long run, even if it turns out people are lying about climate change.
Which they're not, just
Which
to
they're not,
that
which they're
point.
not, which they're not. But so that, and that these solutions, though, should also not be impacting biodiversity, that instead of destroying acres of farm field to build solar farms, you can have agro photovoltaics. You can integrate agriculture with solar panels. You can design wind turbines kill hundreds of thousands of birds every year in the United States, but there's all kinds of ways to design and situate wind turbines so that you're not causing such harm to biodiversity. You can also be thinking about biodiversity itself as part Even other than trees, as part of the solution to climate change. So, for example, sea otters, almost We're almost completely extinct, and then a raft of a couple of dozen were discovered off of Big Sur in the coast of 1930s, and now we're repopulating sea otters, and sea otters are coming back thanks to the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Sea otters eat sea urchins, which sea urchins kill and eat kelp forests. The more sea otters you have, the less sea urchins you have, the more kelp forests you have, the more carbon sequestration you have in kelp forests, the more fish the kelp forests support. So not only do you have more biodiversity, but fish also are containing carbon and are sources of carbon as well. You can think about we've killed a, we have a, currently about 5% of the population of whales that we had before people started whaling. Whales, you can think of whales as magnificent sentient creatures, or you can think of whales as gigantic bags of carbon. Every whale is a giant bag of carbon. When they poop, they feed phytoplankton, which are plant plankton, which themselves are sucking carbon out of the atmosphere. When whales die, they sink to the bottom of the ocean. And that carbon, it takes a really long time for whales to decompose at the bottom of the ocean. And meanwhile, they support an entire ecosystem at the bottom of the ocean, which the more stuff you have feeding on whales, the more carbon those bodies are actually storing as well. So again, thinking in terms of these connections, thinking in terms of nature-based solutions to our problems, including climate change problems, that's a message I like to send, that these two things should be thought about synthetically in an interactive kind of way. Or going to have a climate change solution, think about nature. If you're going to have a biodiversity solution, think about climate change. Don't just Because we don't have enough time to think about these things, or time, money, energy, human power to think about these things as separate things that should be interrelated.
Right. Those were great examples of how, very clear about how the solutions, these what seem like intractable solutions, are really benefited by having that more holistic approach. I'm going to get back to and ask you about the Endangered Species Act in a second. But before that, one of the things that has come up in some of my reading, primarily in this book, What If We Got It Right, were ideas about conservation. And that concept has morphed as well. So I'm wondering how your ideas maybe have changed or where they are now, when we think about, the role of conservation efforts, the types that are more effective, putting effort into conservation in general, all of those things.
That's a big question. I could spend probably the next
I know.
5 hours talking to you about that. One of the ways that my ideas have morphed was that, am I allowed to use dirty words on your, if you throw enough mud at the wall, something's bound to stick. I used to think there's that kind of one size fits all solutions to conservation. Save as much land as you possibly can, put fences around it, and now I think a genuine ecological approach to conservation, ecological mindset says, conservation is fundamentally local, and the solutions that are going to work for you in Shasta County are different than the solutions that are going to work somewhere else in the United States are different than the solutions that are going to work somewhere else in the developed world. It's going to be different than solutions that are going to work in somewhere in the developing world. It all is going to be local, and it depends. And we have tremendous success stories of all different types, but one size doesn't fit all. And I'm much more supportive than I used to be of more aggressive interventions. That is to say, I used to think just keep your hands off and nature will be fine, but we're living in an era where nature exists where and how we want it, and some kind of interventions, translocating species like pieces on a chessboard, genetic manipulations, things like that, have been shown to be effective in ways I never would have guessed. I'll just give you one example. By the late 70s, there are only 22 California condors left in the world. They're California condors are the birds in the United States with the largest wingspan. They're enormous. They're carrion feeders. They would feed on carcasses that would have lead shot and they'd die, or they'd crash into power lines, et cetera, et cetera. So there are only 22 left. And there was a big discussion about, do we just leave the 22 to their own devices, or do we capture every one of those 22 California condors and bring them to a facility and do captive breeding? I never thought that that would work. It's worked spectacularly, and there's now 600 or 700 California condors out there. You can go, you can look up and see them now. And so these kind of aggressive science-backed interventions can be very effective, and increasingly, I think we're going to have to rely on them if we want to have many of the species with whom we share the country or the planet.
And it, in part because of what you're saying, how things have just so accelerated, in terms of and also just to clarify, when you spoke about the solutions have to be, local, that's both the result of the different environment, the different, how what's happening in the environment, as well as culturally, as well as access to resources, right?
100% correct. Now, some of the solutions are also global, and some of the solutions are also national. You need conventions and treaties where countries are working together. You need national laws to produce some of the actions that we're seeing. But then once you get on the ground, ecosystems or local species or local problems or local human communities or local cultures or local, and one size doesn't fit
Right,
all.
right. What's going to stick and what people are going to support. So the Endangered Species Act, what was the Endangered Species Act sort of created to do? And you had let me know that recent changes have really gutted it, and what the impact of that could be.
Right. So the Endangered Species Act was passed in 1973. It was so un it says that the value of species is incalculable, and the needs of the species with whom we share our country take precedence over all kinds of human needs and human economic activities, because ultimately we are dependent upon those species. That may, to me, it's the most radical statute that the United States Congress has ever passed of any type. And despite being radical, it was so uncontroversial. There were four or five no votes in the House of Representatives, and it was so uncontroversial it passed by a voice vote in the Senate. There was no opposition in the Senate. Now, it might be that they didn't quite know what they were doing when they passed it, but this was the world's first big Species and Biodiversity Protection Act. It's led the way. Many other countries have passed similar statutes, and they're, in fact, much better statutes than and more wide-ranging statutes and more effective statutes elsewhere. But for 53 years, we have had this statute. And currently, last time I checked, there was 1,683 species in the United States that are receiving the protections of the Endangered Species Act. We can step back a moment and say, and there's many, many more that are candidates, but they haven't been listed yet. So the fact that there's 1,683 species in our country on the verge of extinction should alone tell us something about that we're in a fundamental lack of balance in the way we all live our lives as individuals and as a country. But the fact is that these are powerful protections for those species as expressed by the US Congress. And this act actually works. It's why it's the United States' most beloved environmental law and why it's the United States' most hated environmental law, because it does say that you can't necessarily do what you want with your property. It does say that there are some places where you can't drill for oil and you can't frack and you can't ride your ORV. And there are some places where they're just off limits because the needs of species, as expressed by the U.S. Congress, trumps, if you don't mind me using that verb, trumps your needs. And so for many years, people have been trying to weaken the statute. Congress has never seriously considered repealing it. I think because you don't want to be the congressperson that goes on record as saying that, we'll just kill off those species. That we I think no one wants to be that person, but there's all kinds of ways that you can weaken it. Nonetheless, it remains incredibly powerful. The biggest threat to biodiversity right now, and the biggest threat to the Endangered Species Act, was a couple of weeks ago. Something that the US Fish and Wildlife Service did, and I'll explain this a little bit. One of the most powerful part of the Endangered Species Act is what's called the take provision. No person, not you, not me, not any corporation, not the government, is allowed to take one of those 1683 listed species. What does it mean to take a species? Take is defined by Congress as to harass, harm, pursue, hunt, shoot, wound, kill, trap, capture, or collect any of those species. Congress didn't tell us what harm means. What does it mean to harm a species? So the US Fish and Wildlife Service in the early 80s defined harm as any act which kills or injures wildlife, including significant habitat modification. Species need habitat. They need a place to live, to eat, to breed, to sleep. That, what I've just said, is the big problem, the big legal problem, and the big ecological problem right now. Is harm about taking your gun out and shooting the last whooping crane, or is it about modifying your land, whether it's your individual private property land or our public lands, in such a way that you interrupt habitat? Since 1981, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been clear that habitat modification that destroys or potentially destroys a listed species is off the table. 2 weeks ago, they changed that definition and said, no, our new definition of harm is only direct harm. It's only when I take my gun out and shoot a listed species, or when I go out and pull up a listed plant. And that basically guts the Endangered Species Act. That just happened 2 weeks ago. Again, everything that ever happens in environmental law immediately gets no matter who it is, no matter if it's pro species, pro biodiversity or anti-biodiversity, immediately the government gets sued, and the environment various different environmental groups are now suing the government, saying that this is an impermissible definition of what counts as harm, given what Congress intended in the Endangered Species Act. That was a long-winded way of saying we've got this incredible, powerful law. If you are a biodiversity advocate, it's an amazing law. It's just an amazing statute. It's amazingly visionary. If you are not a biodiversity advocate and or don't like biodiversity, it's still an amazingly powerful law, which is why you hate it. And it's now, as of July 2026, under an unprecedented threat. There's never been a threat like this to the effectiveness of that law. So that's and there's so much happening right now that I think this has all gone. I don't think people know about this because there's so much going on, so much news, bad news going on, or good news, depending on what your political persuasion is, that this has just gone under the radar. So,
Is that related to what I've been hearing about allowing roads to be built through public lands and vehicles and
that's a it's all interrelated, but I'll talk to you about roads and public lands. If you look at a map of the United States, and you look at where public lands are, you're going to see, especially west of the Mississippi, especially west of the Rockies, it looks incredibly green. Close to 200 million acres, for example, are in our national forest. These are your national forest. If you're listening to this, these are your public lands. The United States Forest Service is the world's largest government builder of roads. They've built 350,000 miles of roads through your national forest. And it's not so that you can get to trailheads. It's so that people, it's that you can, so that you can sell off these lands to logging companies to cut down those trees. So when you look at that 195 million acres, you think these are protected lands. They're not protected lands. Some parts within those are protected lands, but mostly they're open for business. depending upon where the political winds are blowing, depending upon who's president, sometimes they get greater protection, sometimes they get less protection. But under the current administration, there's a lot more road building and opening up lands that had previously been cut off from road building or where the roads have been closed to reopen those so that people can get into log and frack and drill for oil in those lands and graze cattle, et cetera, et cetera.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN and my conversation with environmental lawyer and scholar David Takash.
To just complete that circle and
sure.
go back, that has to do with the Endangered Species Act. If harm doesn't include habitat modification, then you, even if there's any of those listed species there, and if there's any of those endangered species, you can do that now. Whereas 2 weeks ago, you couldn't.
So who's fighting it? I know that like Earth Justice is one organization that I know of. Who else is fighting back that you know of?
The big lawsuits have been filed by Earth Justice, Sierra Club, and Center for Biological Diversity. Center for Biological Diversity is the NGO, the nonprofit that's most directly focused on biodiversity issues. Sierra Club, Earth Justice, they've got a bit wider of a mandate. Center for Biological Diversity is all about biodiversity. There's also a lot of smaller local environmental groups that are going to be fighting this as well. But part of the problem is, I don't think many people know about it, that public, when this rule was originally published by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they got close to 400,000 public comments, most of which were against it, but they did not listen to those comments. They went ahead and published the final rule there. And just that you're at some point, you might ask me, so what can people do about any of this?
I was planning to do it, so please jump in now.
On this one, while we're still here, you can always give money to the groups that are fighting this kind of thing. But on this particular issue, which is the greatest threat since 1973 to protected species and biodiversity in the United States, Congress at any point in the last 53 years could pass a very simple statute that says, harm in the Endangered Species Act includes habitat modification where it kills or potentially kills any of the listed species, period. So you can always have an elected Congress that one cares about non-human life on Earth, cares about the connection between non-human life and human communities and well-being, and would pass a three-sentence statute that says, this is what we meant by harm in the Endangered Species Act.
Mm-hmm.
Everything would be fine, but you would need a different Congress that cares about human civilization.
Yeah. So both advocacy and voting. We've talked a lot on this popular, yeah, on this program too, where we have so many people who, and there's been a coordinated effort to distrust government, not just lawyers, government, you know, processes in general, and. Yeah, you know, I'm wondering, you know, earlier you kind of spoke about, and we had spoken earlier about this effort to undermine people's trust in science and evidence and, you know, education. We could go on. But I'm wondering what you have seen maybe in other countries or in the U.S., that have the potential to be effective in countering that. I don't know if it's counting the erosion, but in terms of standing up or helping people understand the critical role of science and.
Yeah, the erosion of trust in science, I don't think is global. I think it's something that is been very United Statesian. In the other places that I work in the EU, in Australia, in New Zealand, people still listen to scientists when they talk about biodiversity loss or climate change. Science still informs aggressive laws about climate change or about biodiversity loss. And so in those other places, There's a lot more promising legal activity and implementation of law. We're backsliding while other countries are moving forward, in part because people do actually listen to at least what scientists tell us, but also people also experience the fact that every year there's more record temperatures, and every year, climate change. You don't necessarily need to listen to scientists to know that there's a climate crisis happening.
Sure. Sure. I mean, we could look at all our wildfires here, right? And as well as other things that have happened. And those are our, and scientific research is continuing to be funded at,
Correct.
or maybe even, I mean, it sounds like even there may be more of an increase because so many scientists were being sent to the US to be trained, and now with changes to graduate student law as well as research dollars.
Right. So, yeah, not everyone has the resources that the United States has,
Sure.
but AU is funding science, and Australia is funding science, and China is definitely funding science.
So you know, we were speaking earlier and you were just mentioning about legislation and there's things that are happening. What are some areas of legislation that you are seeing emerge that hold promise? It might be specific, you know, pieces of legislation. It may be changes within the environmental law field.
I'll tell you a couple of different things, one very focused on biodiversity and one much broader, that are happening outside of the United States. The EU has really aggressive biodiversity laws. They just passed recently a nature restoration law that requires rehabilitation of degraded ecosystems, taking out dams all over, rehabilitating rivers, et cetera, et cetera. So this is really a very ambitious attempt, which gets layered on other things that the EU has done with biodiversity protection. I can spend a long time talking to you about that, but they have a very wide-ranging suite of laws about biodiversity. Australia has, since 1999, Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, that hasn't that not only protects species but also protects endangered ecosystems, which we don't have in the United States. It hasn't been as effective it might be, so the government commissioned a major study, which is very critical of the government, and now the government is responding in ways to make the act a lot more effective. So again, they're re-examining their own laws and how they're being implemented. One of the most interesting movements in international environmental law is the movement to grant rights to non-human entities like rivers or mountains or whole ecosystems. And this is a legal movement which seems to have caught fire all over the world, except perhaps in the United States, and is spreading very rapidly, and is not just, when I say giving rivers rights, like any kind of right, unless there's a there, unless there is some governance way of making sure to figure out what does that actually mean, and who would actually say what a river wants or what a mountain wants, and what do we actually do with that, it's kind of useless. And many of these places around the world, in New Zealand and Australia and Colombia and Spain, there's actually governance make sure that these rights actually mean something and actions are actually being taken on behalf of these entities like rivers and mountains that now have rights. And this is, to me, a very exciting and promising new direction in environmental law. It's not saying we're going to protect this ecosystem or we're going to protect this species. It's saying what would the world look like and what would our laws look like if we started by saying that all that nature was there first, it should have some kind of primacy and some kind of protections for its own sake, because we depend upon it fundamentally. But what would our societies look like if we started with a fundamental concept that the river, the mountain, the ecosystem is what matters first, and it should have some kind of rights to exist and flourish?
Which it seems like would connect with that a definition of harm. Like, so I think in the Mississippi, you know, where I'm from, like, would the Mississippi want all of the toxins and petrochemicals, dumped
Exactly.
into it? Probably not.
Exactly.
What are when you spoke about governance structures, what do you mean? Like, what who is the body and who what that body what do the representatives consist of and what authority they have?
I'll give you three different examples.
Awesome.
In New Zealand, there's two different laws. One that granted the Whanganui, on the North Island of New Zealand, the Whanganui River is the longest river and it now has rights. And the Te Uaruwera, it was is a mountain ecosystem, former national park on the North Island as well. They've turned governance over to local Maori who elect officials who, in public discussions, will say, we think this is what the river or the mountain's going to want. Just a small example of how that worked. Around Te Uaruwera, this mountain ecosystem with rights, they were going to build a major highway with oil-based asphalt, and the governance group, the Maori governance group, said, "We think the mountain actually doesn't want there to be oil-based highway there. We think that's going to be really bad for the lakes and rivers." And so they've instead found an alternative to oil-based asphalt there because that's what the mountain might want, and the Maori have actually spoken for that. In Australia, in the state of Victoria, the Yarra River is the largest river in the state of Victoria. It goes to Melbourne, it goes throughout agricultural land and wildlife land. And the Yarra River Protection Act created an 11-person council to speak for what the Yarra might want when decisions about the Yarra are being made. What, not just what does the logging industry want, or what does the fishing industry want, or what does the agricultural industry want, or what does this community want, but what does the Yarra actually want? And that committee is comprised of environmental lawyers, farmers. There are two Aboriginal representatives, at least two on the committee. There are city planners. And that's a model that could be used anywhere in the world to say, look, who might be able to speak for what this river or whatever actually wants, and to have a voice at the table? You have someone sitting there at the table speaking, not just for what the humans want, the different human factions, what does the river actually want? In Colombia, the Rio Atrato was the first river in Colombia to be granted rights by the highest court in Colombia. And part of what was created there was a committee composed of local inhabitants who were fundamentally dependent upon the river that had been degraded through illegal mining and logging. Both local inhabitants and representatives from the right government agencies, and they meet regularly to make decisions about the future of the Rio Atrato based upon what does this river actually need, and therefore really what do the communities that depend upon the river actually need. So you have these not just kind of new age ideas about rights for rivers and mountains, but where we're built, again, I'm a law nerd, building the law underneath it, building the governance underneath it so that they're not just words on a page. When we think about rights in the United States, you know, if you've your right to free speech, those are meaningless until you've actually put some kind of law underneath it to say what it actually means. So too, for rights for biodiversity or rights for nature. So that's, to me, is the most one of the most exciting legal developments internationally, where you've got this movement spreading to say, what if we restructure our laws so that we put nature first and what nature needs first, because we all fundamentally depend upon nature.
Yeah, and I hear in that there's in the what does the river want? There's the what does it need for its well-being, for its sustainability, for to continue its place in this ecosystem, including humans.
100% correct.
Yeah. What would need to happen for maybe on a state level, a state in the United States to adopt something?
There are a fundamental change in the way we think about the law in the United States. There are seven states in the United States that say that humans have a fundamental right to a healthy environment. That's at least a recognition that we are fundamentally interconnected with the natural world. Mm. New York State, 2 years ago, however many years ago, just was the last state to pass that law. The other six were in the early 70s. They passed by public referendums. California has a right to water that you have, that all humans have the right to safe, clean drinking water. And the State Water Resources Board has actually done a lot of work to put meaning behind that. That was something that was passed by this California state legislature 10 or 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's still different from what I was talking about. It still says that you have the right to a healthy environment.
Right.
You have the right to clean, which is great because we are, it's a recognition in the law that we're fundamentally interconnected with nature. That's still different than saying the river has the right to exist and be clean. It's a recognition of the interconnection in a different form. But that's still three quarters of countries in the world have a human right to a healthy environment, either written into their constitution or passed by statute or found by courts. The United States is in the minority of not having such a right.
I'm going to ask you what seems like a completely different question about AI, which, you know, we've been talking about on the show in terms of surveillance technology and, you know, all of the problems when it comes to equity and justice, you know, related to that. In your field, when it comes to research or legislation creation, maybe monitoring efforts, how you are seeing AI, maybe not generated, assisted efforts, the role of that, and what, if anything, we should be careful about when employing AI in those.
I like to joke that I left my full-time job just in time to not have to think about AI. So I can be a dinosaur and not have to think about AI. All of the things that you've talked about on the show, the dangers of AI, are present in the environment a lot. AI, on the other hand, can also help us with data aggregation and data monitoring for species well-being, for ecosystem well-being, for understanding forest cover. There are ways that AI can be a powerful tool to help biodiversity or to help us in climate change solutions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the dangers are all the dangers that you've talked mm-hmm. about on your show. The revolution that is... AI is coming, but the real revolution in the last, let's say, quarter century in terms of biodiversity is the DNA revolution and what we've learned about genetic technology and how that can actually help biodiversity, help us monitor biodiversity, help us create coral in laboratories that can be heat resistant and that can be transplanted so that reefs have a chance to survive, to have species... members of species that are affected by pathogens in the wild, where you can, in a laboratory, in a zoo, you can genetically manipulate the species so that they're disease resistant and then reestablish populations. This kind of genetic technology is the really, for me, the very exciting part about biodiversity conservation law. Obviously, this also has potential detractors and negatives, but when used effectively, there's environment DNA, which is you can go to a forest or to a creek and collect samples and use what you get to know what's there just because of what you have traces in your DNA sample. These are really powerful, exciting tools that help us monitor and manage biodiversity.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that leads to one of my last questions about, we hear so many terrifying stories, and we related to climate change and biodiversity loss, but there are also good things going on that are important and not given as much attention. And clearly, it sounds like that is one thing that could give one hope, in terms of what we can do. And I'm wondering if there are any other efforts, tools or research or laws, in addition to the ones that you've mentioned, that could give us hope in this moment.
One of the nice things about being a teacher, whether you're no matter who, whether you're a college professor or an elementary school teacher, is that you face the next generation who are really interested in this stuff and really want to make a living working on behalf of climate or biodiversity. I'm fond of saying to my students, the good news about the fact that we're destroying the planet is that there's lots of jobs for lawyers, and it is a growth industry, and there's lots of students who want to do this. They want to do well and pay off their loans by doing good in the world. That's one place to definitely find hope. All of the things that I've mentioned, you in Northern California, taking down the dams on the Klamath River and seeing what that means for both human cultural revitalization of the tribes that have long been lobbying for that, but also ecological restoration, what's happening with salmon, what's happening with that other biodiversity, even since just in the short amount of time since the dams have come down. There all of these local actions all around the world and in the United States where people who care about the world around them are actually advocating and successfully advocating for ecological restoration, for species preservation, for land preservation. The growth. The 50 years ago, there was no such thing. Maybe I'm wrong about this. There was no such thing as land trusts. Your listeners might want to double check my math there. Now there's thousands in the United States, and these are places where if we're interested in solutions that synergize and intertwine climate change and biodiversity conservation, the fact that land trusts are helping to preserve and steward land for perpetuity, that you as a property owner can put a deed on your land to keep it forever not developed. This is, and that there's millions of acres in the United States that have not been preserved that way. That's a tremendously powerful thing. And all of that is grassroots. All of that comes from local people who want to see their community not turn into shopping malls and auto plazas, right? That's all local, fundamentally local. And that's one place where everyone can always get involved.
So, David, we're coming to our end, and I'm wondering if there's anything else I should. There's so many things I should have asked you, I'm guessing, or anything that you want to say, that you haven't yet said in this conversation.
I've talked much too much in this conversation. I think I've said everything. Readers, listeners, part of what I sometimes hear is people don't know where to get information. The best newspaper that covers environmental, biodiversity, and climate issues is The Guardian, which is published out of London. They're the best mainstream news source. But there are other environmental news services like grist.org is an environmental news service that you get things delivered to your inbox that keeps you up to date. And a lot of what Grist covers is really hopeful and optimistic, and sometimes it's not. Mongabay, Mongabay, is another news service. They do a lot of biodiversity coverage, and a lot of their stories are, I mean, their stories are really well written, fascinating, and just filled with positive examples of what's going on in the world around biodiversity. RARE, RARE, is another organization, again, that will send you stuff that their specialty is cultural connections and cultural pride and biodiversity, and how do you revitalize both culture and nature synergistically? There's all of, and once you, again, this can take you can spend 5 or 10 minutes a day just reading this stuff, and a lot of those things will link you to other stuff. So those are some good ways of keeping this in a society where our attention span is often fractured and where there's so much coming at us. Those are some good sources to keep biodiversity sort of at the forefront and to give you inspiration and hope about what you can actually do.
That's great. And we'll put links to those in the archived copy.
Definitely share it. Yeah.
Yeah, as well as ways to connect with you in case people are interested.
Right. I'm happy to answer. I'm retired. I have time on my hands. I'm happy to answer any questions. So I'll send. We'll put my information on your website.
Awesome.
Good.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You have
Thanks.
been. You've been listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN, community supported radio.
No, I can't let go. I can't get high and I can't get low. I cannot stay and I cannot go. I can't say yes and I can't say no. I can't hold on. No, I can't let go. No, I can't let go. Memories long ago. Remember these. I can't let go. Remind me, please. Who am I, though? I don't believe I can't let go. No, I can't let go.
Thank you for listening to Bending the Arc by KKRN. Our theme music is provided by Jacob Akana.
I can't get high.